And on RN, this is The Body Sphere, all about the physical and what you can do with and to your body. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith. Lovely to be back with you and taking you to watery depths today to meet some mermaids. Yes, they really do exist. And there's one coming up out of the water right now.
My name's Mermaid Narissa, and in human life, my name is Shelley, and I'm a music student from Melbourne.
I'm Mermaid Aradia, and in real life, I'm Katie Lasker, and I'm studying archaeology at Monash University.
I'm Mermaid Bolitania. In real life, my name is also Katie, and I have an arts degree from Monash University, and now I'm studying science there.
Narissa, Aradia and Volitania, when they're not being students, are modern-day mermaids, complete with fishtails and shell bras. So what's with turning yourself into these kind of fantasy bodies, half fish, half woman? Later in The Body Sphere, they'll tell you. First, though, you've got to meet the perfect woman and then the perfect man. How good is that? The perfect woman also happened to be a professional mermaid. Well, I'm at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, in the basement of the museum. It's full of wonderful things. And I'm with Peter Cox, who's the curator for Australian history here. And Peter, you've brought out from storage a rather marvellous thing. Can you do the reveal for us and tell us what it is?
Okay.
Wow.
There it is. Well, this is a mermaid costume, yellow with lots of diamantes sewn in, so the wearer would slip into that and appear...
Be a mermaid.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very beautiful. These diamantes all look like they're hand-sewn, individually sewn.
Yes, they do. It's certainly a one-off costume which was made for a very specific purpose.
Okay, so let's talk about for whom and for what.
Well, this was a costume used in stage performances by Annette Kellerman, who was an Australian performer who began as a long-distance swimmer and developed a unique form of vaudeville entertainment around 1907, in which she would appear on stage in a giant water tank and perform underwater ballet and diving. So she kind of styled herself as an exotic mermaid character and was immensely successful in England and then United States, where she was very big in the vaudeville scene for a number of years. When Annette Kellerman appeared at the New York Hippodrome in 1917, she appeared on stage with a supporting cast that included 200 mermaids, all these young women, you know, blending together, each swimming in time. And, you know, you could imagine that as the forerunner to synchronized swimming and also the forerunner to those sort of Busby Berkeley water spectaculars, one of which was a film called Million Dollar Mermaid, in which Esther Williams played Annette Kellerman. Before then, Annette was forging a film career for herself. And she starred in a number of films, again, in which she played this heroine mermaid in a number of films such as Neptune's Daughter and A Daughter of the Gods.
And Siren of the Sea and Venus of the South Seas. This was all in the sort of 1910s, 1920s. Now, this costume, it's yellow fabric. Is it, what is it, cotton? It doesn't look very waterproof.
No, it's cotton. We have dozens and dozens of her stage costumes here in the Powerhouse Museum's collection.
And this is the only mermaid tail, though, isn't it?
Yes, this is the only mermaid tail. Quite beautiful and beautifully made. And the way it tapers in, hugging her body shape, her legendary body shape, because she was proclaimed the world's most perfectly formed woman in America by a certain Dr. Sargent.
Yes, at Harvard.
That's right. Mm. She had the proportions of the Venus de Milo.
And that's Peter Cox at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, the custodian of Annette Kellerman's mermaid costume. This is The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith here on RN. And okay, so that's the perfect woman. Now it's time to meet the perfect man. And who is this perfect man? Well, he's dead. In fact, he died in 1925. But in the late 19th and early 20th century, Eugene Sandow had the most famous male body in the world. David Waller is the author of The Perfect Man, The Muscular Life and Times of Eugene Sandow, and he joins us from London. Now, before we get into detail about the great Sandow and his fabulous musculature, you're actually related to the perfect man, aren't you?
Yes, he's a very distant relation. He's a sort of great uncle by marriage, no genetic connection at all. But it's bizarre what people will say once they know that I've written this book. They often say, oh, well, you look just like him, which is obviously complete rubbish.
Well, looking like him is no bad thing, though.
Oh, I quite agree. Very flattering.
Well, now, most of Eugene Sandow's adult life centred around Britain and the USA, although he was Prussian, German. He was also illegitimate, and as a teenager, he ran away to the circus and worked variously across Europe as a strongman, an acrobat, a wrestler, an artist's model. What got him to London and fame and fortune?
Well, as you summed up, he led a kind of wandering life around Europe, doing a variety of somewhat disreputable things. But his big break came in October 1889. The way he told it, he was wandering down a beach in Venice, on the Lido in Venice, when an artist, a British artist by the name of Aubrey Hunt, caught a glimpse of his magnificent form in his bathing trunks, no doubt, and told him all about a competition that was taking place in London.
And this being spotted in Venice all sounds a bit Death in Venice.
And it's also somewhat likely that it was invented afterwards. I think what really happened was that Sandow and a bunch of associates working on the continent got to hear about this competition taking place on the Royal Aquarium Music Hall stage in London. And to cut a long story short, it was very like a talent competition that you might find on TV, sort of like X Factor or Britain's Got Talent. I'm sure there are Australian equivalents.
Indeed.
And you had a chance to prove yourself the strongest man in the world. And the incumbent performers, led by another German called Samson, were challenging the British population to find the strongest man in the world. And no one had stepped up to this challenge until Sandow came along when he jumped the stage at the Royal Aquarium. And I mean, he got up on stage wearing evening dress. He looked like a gentleman out on the town. And Samson laughed at him. The audience derided him, in fact, because he looked so ordinary. And then once the challenge had been accepted, he ripped all his clothes off. He literally sort of pulled apart his dinner jacket and shirt beneath to reveal this muscular form. And of course, he won this competition.
All right, well, let's talk about what he could do, because after this contest where he defeats Samson, Sandow goes on to become really a music hall sensation in Britain and then a vaudeville star in the US. What were some of his more flamboyant theatrical displays of strength?
One act that he did quite regularly was to, again, he would come on dressed in his evening gear, and someone on stage would be playing a grand piano, and Sandow would affect to be deeply upset by this poor playing. He would indicate to the pianist to stop, and the pianist refused to stop, and then Sandow would go over and pick up the piano and the pianist and carry them off stage.
Didn't he also do things with horses?
Yeah, he could pick up horses, for example. He would restrain the weight of horses. He formed himself into a bridge. And this was kind of like a popular trick of his. He lay on his back, actually, and put a plank of wood over his torso, over his stomach and chest, and then the horse walked across it.
Could he really do these things, or was he faking it?
He could do these things. I mean, there was a lot of skill in what he did. So, for example, when he picked up the piano, I mean, there was a handle behind the piano that allowed him to grab it and make the whole thing a lot easier than it looked. But he was examined many times by the likes of Houdini, and Houdini knew a thing or two about trickery. And Sandow clearly wasn't faking it in the same way that some music hall stars were.
Well, at the time, he wasn't the only strong man on the circuit. Why was he such a roaring success, do you think?
Well, his contemporaries thought, for a start, that he was able to be a lot more interesting and entertaining on stage. So that's one aspect of it. He was a showman. The other aspect, of course, was his body that itself was deemed to be so fascinating. Unlike many muscle men, it was well proportioned. He was 5'10" tall. He wasn't a giant who could, with a few flexes of his limbs, demonstrate really quite extraordinary development of his main muscles.
He also did private sessions in his dressing room, didn't he, after his performances?
Yeah, I mean, that really started in America. This kind of backstage routine was developed where society ladies could pay a little bit extra to come and have a look close up. And not only, they didn't just look, they were allowed to touch, they were allowed to feel and caress his muscles, and there are reports of fainting and squeaking and so forth. It was clearly a very impressive sight.
Well, the photos of him, I have to say, they are pretty sexy. He is really saucy, you know, in sort of He-Man bodybuilder poses, wearing only a fig leaf and a pair of sandals. And if I may say, the fig leaf really only serves to draw attention to his almost nakedness. But as the perfect man, I mean, how perfect was his body?
Well, I think it's clearly a matter of taste. He appeared to contemporaries to capture, to literally embody the perfection of classical statues. People in that day and age really hadn't seen anything like it. And they were prepared to say that it was perfect. I believe, you know, in fact, it wasn't entirely perfect. The family tradition, for example, is that he had flat feet, but people weren't too concerned about that.
Also, he was measured and tested when he was in the US by a Harvard professor, Dr. Dudley Sargent.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, what he said was that his muscles are of a very fine quality, and his muscles, particularly in the upper arms and back, are developed to an extraordinary degree. To quote, the trapezius and extensors and flexors of the legs and thighs are also tremendous.
And Dr. Sargent declared him a sort of modern-day Hercules. And what's interesting about that is Dr. Sargent also measured and tested Annette Kellerman, the great Australian swimmer who came about 20 years after Eugene Sandow and who, like him, was a sort of superstar of the pool, the stage. And Dr. Sargent declared her the perfect woman because her proportions matched the Venus de Milo. Except, of course, that Annette Kellerman had arms and legs.
I hadn't realised that. Maybe they would have been the perfect couple.
Well, indeed. Exactly. This is The Body Sphere on RN. Amanda Smith with you, along with David Waller in London, talking about the perfect man of the late 19th and early 20th century, Eugene Sandow. Now, David, what fascinates me about Sandow is how he straddled a number of fields. He was a performer on the popular stage, but he also took on high art associations, you know, posed as classical statues and as characters from Greek and Roman mythology. And there was definitely the element of the erotic to him, but this was also hitched to a kind of scientific inquiry, like the Harvard professor was doing with him. So it's interesting how he legitimised and extended his appeal.
And by the way, the fig leaf that you allude to, I mean, there's a lot of genuine academic inquiry into exactly how that was attached. Was it a wire?
Yes.
Was it somehow glued on? Or is it a sort of 19th century equivalent of photoshopping? I don't think we'll ever know. But that's an aside. But he was very clever to make his appearances seem respectable. And what he did to ensure that was to associate himself with doctors, with military men, and to present his exhibition as something scientific, something healthy. And his own exercise program, which he codified in the late 1890s, contributed to a boom in what was known in those days as physical culture. And this was, the way he described it, was the rational pursuit of exercise, using spring-loaded dumbbells. He had his own patented dumbbells.
Well, in his heyday, what did his body stand for, do you reckon?
It stood for the possibility of self-improvement, the possibility of perfectibility through your own efforts. There was a strong Victorian tradition of self-help as applied to other aspects of life, like building a business, making some money. But he was the first really to apply that kind of ideology to the whole question of physical fitness. And so when you looked at him, he represented an ideal, but he placed the idea in your mind that if you worked hard, you too could look like him.
Well, in the course of writing this biography, you actually put yourself on the Sandow exercise program, his routine. How was it for you?
I bought some of the famous Eugene Sandow spring-loaded dumbbells on eBay for rather a lot of money, I must say. They're something of a collector's item. And they're very beautiful. They come in what looks like a biscuit tin. They come in a little red tin. The handles are coated in leather. But they are £3 each, which is not very heavy. And that gives you a false sense of security. I got out the guidebook that came with these devices, the original guidebook to the 19 exercises, and it said start off gently with 6 or 7 repetitions once a day. And I did 6 or 7 repetitions of these exercises, and I really felt absolutely nothing. So I went on and did another 10. So I probably did 30 or 40 that evening, and I felt very pleased with myself. Until the next morning when I got up and, you know, I could barely move. The point being, they were extraordinarily efficient in reaching individual muscles. So I learned to use these devices with a lot more respect after that.
David Waller is the author of The Perfect Man, The Muscular Life and Times of Eugene Sandow. David is also a great-nephew by marriage of the perfect man. Eugene Sandow died in 1925, only 58 years old, which is a bit young, really, for the perfect man, isn't it? It's said that he died from lifting up a car that he'd run off the road, one exertion too many. On RN, you're listening to The Body Sphere, and I'm Amanda Smith. So the perfect man was a professional strongman. The perfect woman, Annette Kellerman, was a professional mermaid. Such a thing, though, isn't only the stuff of old movies or vaudeville shows or myths and fairy tales. Come with me now to the deep end of the pool to meet some modern mermaids.
Aha, uh-huh, so this is how a mermaid puts her tail on.
Lies down. We don't like you to see usually.
The transformation is less than elegant.
Yeah, they have to be really tight.
It's more or less just trying to pull on a very stiff, very sticky sock.
Hey, yours is gorgeous.
Ah, yeah, it's not my own creation. I can't claim that.
But who made it?
A tail maker from America, actually.
So, oh, really? This is an imported mermaid tail.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I'm the uncrafty one, so I had a go at making a few tails of my own and they sort of went really up to scratch, so decided to invest in one instead.
Beautiful green colour.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's really nice.
In water, these are modern mermaids Nerissa, Aradia and Volitania. On land, they're university students Shelley Dunlop, Katie Lasco and Katie Dawson.
I can remember as a child watching The Little Mermaid over and over and over again and never getting sick of it. Of course, I knew all the words to all the songs. You know, I remember once dragging myself around the house because I worked out that mermaids wouldn't actually be able to walk, and therefore if I wanted to be one, I shouldn't either. So it comes from very early on for me.
I think my parents played a lot in my journey to becoming a mythical creature, because we used to like walk around these beautiful forests in the Mount Dandenong Ranges, and I remember once my dad threw like a little pebble into bush or something, and I was like, oh, I think I saw one, I think I saw a fairy. And so for me, mythological creatures were always a fairly plausible thing, and so becoming a mermaid is just, you know, a lifetime of believing in mermaids and loving to sit at the bottom of the pool, being a scuba diver, just loving being under the water.
I'm similar to Shelley in that I used to absolutely love The Little Mermaid and I would never get sick of it, and I still sort of never get sick of it.
In that Disney film, The Little Mermaid actually doesn't want to be a mermaid. She wants to be human and have legs and feet, so it's actually the reverse to what you were doing.
Do you, though, feel at home, more at home in the water? Katie Lesko, you mentioned you're a scuba diver.
Definitely. I mean, over the last couple of years when I've gotten my license, I've been in and out of the water almost constantly over summer. And for me, the wonder of the underwater world is because the creatures are so unlike anything we have on land, and there's almost a weightless, dreamlike quality when you're under the water, and there's just nothing more peaceful and serene, and so I can't get enough of it.
I've always lived in rural areas, so it was always a long way to the beach for me, and every time I get near water, I relax instantly. Whether I'm stressed or something, just always get in the bath or something like that. And now I actually live 5 minutes walk from the beach, so that's sort of a dream come true for me.
So what is this all about, being mermaids? Is it about being a kind of beautiful, bewitching kind of siren who lures men onto rocks?
There are lots of different facets to being mermaid, I think, nowadays, where we stand for a very environmentally friendly conservation message, where we use our image as mermaids to try and get people interested and interact with us in a way that, you know, a scuba diver talking to someone or a student talking to someone just wouldn't get that kind of reaction. I think we make people consider what they're doing to their environment when we put on a fishtail, because we can say, look, overfishing is really bad because this is our home and, you know, these things are happening to it.
So you mentioned overfishing. Have you got a range of sort of environmental issues that you campaign for as mermaids?
We kind of each have our own special ones. One of the really big issues that's happening at the moment in South Australia is that the cuttlefish are actually not turning up to their breeding site. There's only like one small place where the giant Australian cuttlefish tend to breed. And there used to be thousands upon thousands upon thousands, and the reports this year is that there's none.
And as a mermaid, you reckon you can get a message about that across better than as a student?
Yeah, I mean, kids tend to react better to us because they're like, oh, you know, I've seen Ariel and things, and, you know, you come from the ocean, so clearly you know what's going on there. And I think we're a lot more memorable. I mean, you don't see many mermaids. You see lots of people talking at you, but you don't see many mermaids talking.
I guess the message that I get across is on a little bit of a different track, although I am very supportive of the conservation messages. I really like encouraging water safety for kids. I almost drowned once as a kid. It wasn't a super dramatic scene, but it was kind of scary. So I really want to encourage kids to learn to swim and to be comfortable in the water so that that doesn't happen.
All right, so where do you get your tails from and what are they made from?
Our various tails are made from different things. When we first started out, I think we were all using fabric tails, weren't we? So we were using monofins, which are what freedivers use for their dolphin kick, and we made kind of fabric skins to go over those to cover our legs and come down below the tail fluke section. And we've since evolved a bit more beyond that, and I think Katie Dawson's tail is now made of wetsuit neoprene with silicone over the top.
Yeah, that's right. My tail's more or less a mermaid-shaped wetsuit. It's got silicone, just any caulking silicone you'd get from Bunnings, just spread over the top with some texturing to make it look a bit scaly. And I'm a lionfish, so I'm red and white striped, and I've got sort of spiny fins coming off it.
Is this a global trend, young women being mermaids?
Yes, it's very big over in the US. We actually are all involved in an internet community that's mainly based in the US of lots of people who do what we do, but also around the world. It's definitely something that's relatively new and that people are kind of cottoning onto and going, I want to do that too. And
why? What's the thing?
You get to swim like a mermaid. Let's just put it very simple. You know, as a child, you put your legs together and try and dolphin kick to the bottom of the pool, and this is bringing this childhood idea to life. You know, a lot of people just do it for fun, and we started out like that. Now we do it professionally, and we do parties and events and
that kind of thing, and it's great to be able to see smiles on kids' faces and encourage them to feel the way we felt when we were their age.
What does it feel like to be in a mermaid tail, to embody a mermaid?
It's actually, with our particular tails, it's actually easier to swim in them than it is as a human, because the monofin is made for efficient swimming. It's a lot faster, and when you take the tail off, it's like, oh God, I can't swim anymore.
Do you become something other than your usual self? I mean, does it feel like a transformation?
I think so. As soon as you put the tail on, you're doing something that people aren't expecting you to do, and so you become more confident.
it's as though we're just becoming different people. I mean, Volitania is, I think you definitely come out of your shell when you are a mermaid. Yep.
Mermaid coming out of her shell. I love it. Now, some would say, though, that being a mermaid is an emblem of female disempowerment, a sort of disabling thing, a bit like having your feet bound. What do you say to that?
I don't think so. Perhaps it is if you're on land, but once you're in the water, you're not going to catch us. So I think it's perhaps the opposite of that once we're actually in the water.
The legends about mermaids, though, going back to ancient cultures, way back to Assyrians, also Greeks, through the 19th century to Hans Christian Andersen, they all cast these sort of half-women, half-fish as beautiful but tragic figures. You know, the Hans Christian Andersen story, in that the little mermaid gives up her life in water to be near the man she loves, only he marries someone else. And on land, she walking for her is like walking on broken glass. So she lives in both physical and emotional torment. What account of that story do you take?
I think everyone lives in two worlds. And with the mermaid, I mean, she'll never be fully part of the human world, but she'll never be fully part of the undersea world either. And I think everyone kind of feels like that at some point in their lives, wanting to kind of live in a fantasy world, whether that's an idea of yourself, an idea of someone else, or, you know, just not being able to cope with everyday life. And I think that's what these stories kind of get across, that you're not fully of one world and you're not fully of other. But I guess as a message to someone, you don't have to conform. You can be part of both worlds and still be happy and still be fulfilled.
Presumably it's also a fitness thing.
Yes.
A little, yeah. I think we've all definitely gotten fitter for starting mermaiding.
Yeah, there are also mermaids in the States who hold, there's one called Mermaid Cariel, and she holds a thing called a Fins to Fitness class where she teaches people how to do the dolphin kick, which really engages all the muscles of your body because it's essentially like an undulating sensation through your body to the fin, which carries you along. And it is very tiring and it engages so many muscles.
All right, so fitness, fun, aquatic, a little bit erotic, I'd have to say. I mean, do you take on that it is a bit sexy?
A little bit, I think. Though I wouldn't call myself a pin-up, there's definitely an element of, you know, people are looking at me, so I'm going to sort of show that I'm confident and I can be that pin-up in their eyes.
Fabulously overblown music there from Pirates of the Caribbean 4. Ooh, those mermaids, not so nice in that movie. Our three mermaids, though, they were lovely. Mermaids with a message, too, about marine ecology and water safety. Nerissa, Aradia and Volitania, otherwise known as Shelley Dunlop, Katie Lasco and Katie Dawson. There's a link to their Mermaidens website on the Bodysphere site. Also some gorgeous photos of them there, as well as pics of the perfect man. Check him out. And while you're there, post a comment if you feel like it. abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Amanda Smith.